I'm here just to be here and be a witness and put my body between the oppressor and the beautiful movement that must grow. Because this is, I've been waiting for this for 30 years. This is the most hopeful thing I've seen in a long time.
Really exciting to see that so many people have come out, and not just, I mean, you kind of look around and there's more people who are kind of like looking maybe touristy, kind of viewing it, but also seem to be interested in, you know, not having it be kicked out of the park. So I think that it's exciting that there's, you know, people that are down here to show support in all, in many different forms.
It is an extremely exciting development. In fact, it's kind of spectacular, unprecedented. There's never been anything like it that I can think of. If the bonds and associations that are being established in these remarkable events can be sustained through a long, hard period ahead, because victories don't come quickly, it could turn out to be a very significant moment in American history.
In the past week, we've seen a nationwide campaign to evict protesters from the Occupy encampments, including mass arrests in Zuccotti Park at the heart of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Locally, Portlanders came out in force to support the Occupy movement on Saturday, November 12th. With the announcement of a midnight eviction by Mayor Sam Adams, thousands rallied in the streets to show support and delay an eviction.
With recent events, many are asking, what's next for the movement? Tonight on Circulate Radio, we focus on political analysis and the economics that gave rise to this historic movement, the financial crisis caused by Wall Street and the financial institutions it represents. We'll hear from Canadian economist Jim Stanford, labor activist Christina Towne, and professor, activist, and longtime critic of capitalism, Noam Chomsky. Stay tuned.
Jim Stanford is a Canadian economist who works for the Canadian Auto Workers and founded the Progressive Economics Forum. On this segment of CKUT's Morning After program, he speaks about his book, Economics for Everyone. The first voice you'll hear is Courtney Kirkby, host of the program.
I think an interesting thing about your book right now is that we can see a trend of more and more sort of quote-unquote ordinary people or activists or social justice advocates becoming much more interested in actually learning about the nuts and bolts of what economics is and what finance is. I think before it was sort of this unreachable thing that was supposed to be incomprehensible to the average person. So do you see people using your book more as a tool recently versus when it first came out?
Well, I sure hope so, because that's the whole idea. I have a slogan that says economics is too important to be left to the economists. I'm a real believer in popular economics education, in all of us taking on a bit of responsibility to learn how the economy works, learn how it doesn't work, and have the confidence, individually and collectively, to express our views and our preferences and fight for our interests in the economy. There's a tendency for economists to sort of portray economics as this mystical, almost religious discipline. You know, all of the phony mathematical formulas and all the computer models and all the jargon that they use, that they invoke, and they present themselves as the high priests of this mystical religion called economics and sort of pat the rest of us on the head and say, there, leave it to the experts. But I think my goal as a union economist, as a socialist economist, is to try and equip average people, workers, activists, environmentalists, members of our community, equip them with the tools and the confidence to reclaim economics in a way. To say, no, economics is not about the quarterly GDP statistics, and economics is certainly not about the pointless ups and downs of the stock market that we hear about every day. Ultimately, economics is about work, production, consumption, sustaining ourselves and our families and our environment and our communities. That is the essence of real economics, and we have something to say about that. We shouldn't be silenced or intimidated by the phony jargon of the economics profession as it currently works.
I think one thing about the economics profession, especially within universities, is that they tell students and themselves, I think there isn't an ideology behind economics. There's not a political agenda. I mean, that was a separation between economics and politics. But I don't think that really is the case. The economics that is being taught across Canada has a clear bias, like political bias. So I think your book breaks with that or tries to, like, how do you feel about the idea of economics being linked to politics?
Anytime an economist stands at the front and says, I'm value free, I'm just a technical expert and I'm giving you technical advice, you know, that's when you have to reach for your wallet and make sure that it's still in your pocket, because it's a lie and it's a deliberate lie. You know, they'll stand at the front and say, according to our technical models, you must tighten your belt, you must cut your wage, you must give up this public service or that public service because the technical models tell us that that's the truth. And it's nonsense. There is no such thing as a value-free economics. Economics has always been laden with ideology, with interests, economic interests and political interests and cultural interests. And we might as well be honest about that. Instead of trying to pretend that it's a neutral science, like, you know, physics or something like that, we have to recognize it's a social science. Economics is the study of human beings and how we interact. And inevitably, human beings have competing or conflicting interests, and you have to know what side you're on. So in a way, you know, this book is an attempt to create an economics for the average person rather than an economics for the elite, who are the ones who currently control our economy.
I think it's been clear also in the Occupy Wall Street movement and the Occupy movements internationally that citizens are beginning to sort of stand up to financial institutions, saying, you know, banks and governments, you've wronged us, and now we're looking for solutions. Can you comment on sort of the maybe economic analysis coming from the Occupy movements?
I'm really pleased to finally see some people pushing back. You know, it seems incredibly ironic. We're 3 years after the greatest crisis in free market capitalism in 80 years. And yet it's clearly the right, the conservative forces, the pro-business forces that have seized the political initiative in the wake of that crisis. And that's incredibly ironic. You see it most, of course, in America with the Tea Party and everything. But here in Canada, you've got the Harper government, and elsewhere around the world, you've had very conservative pro-business forces say, look, this is a crisis and you've got to do what I say. And finally, we have a political space and a cultural space that's pushing back and saying, no, hold on, we didn't create this crisis. It was you who created this crisis, you who are in those towers speculating on paper assets instead of actually producing real goods and services. And we're not going to tighten our belts to pay for a crisis we didn't create. So I know the Occupy movements have been criticized by many commentators as being too naive, too diffuse, not having a focused analysis or focused demands. I think that's nonsense, frankly. I think the core idea that's motivated the Occupy movement is a simple idea that there is a very small elite, and I think that 1% is actually an empirically verifiable estimate of the elite. In my own book, I go through and add up the proportion of society that makes their money off of wealth rather than off production, and it is somewhere between 1 and 2% of the population. So that 1% versus the 99% slogan that the Occupy movement has used is actually a verifiable empirical judgment on how capitalism really works today. And they've pointed out that that 1% has profited while the rest of us are suffering. And what's more, the 1% is telling us to suffer some more. So in that general sense, I think their analysis is bang on. Do we have to flesh it out with more detail and more statistics and more specific demands that we're fighting for? Of course we do. And that will come with time as we build those movements and press on with the fight back.
Sort of going across the ocean, this morning the Greek Prime Minister reneged on the referendum for the country to see if they wanted to accept austerity measures package being proposed. Can you, or how do you apply the economics principles outlined in your book to that situation?
Well, there's, I think, an interesting chapter in this book that talks about government under capitalism and how government works, and tries to debunk a bit the assumption that capitalism is a democratic system. In fact, historically, capitalism is not a democratic system. Whatever democracy we have is something that we got in spite of capitalism, that we had to fight for over centuries, really, and that there's an inherent anti-democratic nature just given the immense influence that the owners of wealth, whether that's financial wealth or corporations in the real economy, the concentrated ownership of that wealth and the fact that the whole economy depends on what people do with that wealth, that gives them an immense influence that is at odds with the principles of democracy. Now, that core insight that capitalism is not inherently democratic, in fact, it goes in the other direction, I think is validated by the offensive things that are happening in Europe. I mean, already for 2 years now, every important decision in Greece has not been made by the elected representatives of the Greek people. It's been made by this so-called Troika, is what it's called, which is officials from the EU, from the IMF, and then some of the officials from the Greek government. And they've made unilateral decisions on a huge range of different measures, most of which have nothing directly to do with the Greek debt and repaying the Greek debt. Everything from how public services are delivered, to how labor markets are regulated, to how truck drivers function. Incredible anti-democratic reach by the decisions of this Troika into every area of Greek life. And it's all justified by this supposed supremacy of the financial markets over the whole system. And, you know, thankfully the Greek people and the Greek unions and the Greek social movements have been fighting back, and we all owe them a debt of thanks. And the legitimacy of the government's role in this has reached the breaking point. That's why Papandreou first said, okay, he kind of threw up his hands and said, we're going to have a referendum and we're going to let the people decide, because he had no democratic credibility for what he was doing within Greece. And that it was kind of an act of desperation on his part. But the world financiers and the German and French governments and the EU officials were shocked that something so important, a decision so important, could be handed over to the people. So they've strong-armed Papandreou into giving up on that idea. Ironically, or maybe not ironically, stock markets around the world soared today on news that the Greek referendum was cancelled. So I think that in and of itself is pretty interesting evidence that capitalism and democracy are not synonymous, as Milton Friedman would have us believe. In fact, they're antithetical.
And how can people find your book, the French version of your book and the English version?
The French version of the book is published in Montreal by Lux Editeur, and it can be ordered from them on the website if you Googled under Lux, L-U-X, in Montreal. And the website is www.luxediteur.com. The English version is called Economics for Everyone, and it's available from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, our progressive think tank in English Canada, and their website is policyalternatives.ca. So either in English or in French, I hope it will be a useful learning tool for us in the movements who are trying to refuse to pay for the crisis that we didn't create and use this moment to try and fight for something better.
That was economist Jim Stanford. We now listen to an interview conducted by Richard Wolff, which aired on his program Economic Update on WBAI in New York City on November 5th. He interviews Occupy Wall Street activist Christina Town on how and why she got involved in the movement, and also about the definition of wealth and its creation. This is Richard Wolff.
Christina Town. And she's a person very active with the Occupy Wall Street, which is a few blocks from where we are sitting right now. So without more ado, let me welcome you, Christina, to our program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's begin, Christina, and tell us a little bit about yourself, sort of what you were doing before the Occupy Wall Street got going and drew you into its activities.
Sure. For about the last 10 years or so, I've been a research analyst and financial analyst in the U.S. labor movement. So um, for for about 2000, from about 2001 until about 2010. I worked for the old Clothing and Textile Workers Union, which you know, used to be a very powerful union in New York City when New York City had just masses of apparel jobs. But by the time I ended up working with that union, those jobs had pretty much gone overseas. I mean, the union was really a victim of globalization. They've gone overseas and then overseas from there many, many times. Apparel is, because of its mobility and, you know, lack of capital investment, it's really one of the bottom of the barrel industries that you can find in places like Bangladesh and Lesotho and Mozambique. And at first they went to China, and then from China they ran to places that have even less labor rights. Let's see. After 2010, just through connections at grad school, some professors, I started working for a public sector union, an affiliate of a state federation, affiliate of the the American Federation of Teachers. And in that process, I got really involved with public finance. So I started, you know, studying the municipal bond market a lot, public budgets, that sort of thing.
Trying to understand where the money came from to pay public employees.
Right, exactly. Right. And of course, at that time, it was, what, two years into the crisis. So austerity, you know, is now a household word. And austerity budgets and the war on public sector workers had already started in earnest. It was interesting to see how much of our budget problems are actually, you know, revenue problems, as people like to say, and how much is really spin. You know, if you're a good politician, you can make the numbers say whatever you want them to say.
Right.
Honestly.
So in a sense, you've been involved in two workers' struggles in which first globalization really decimated the situation for working people. And then you moved to the public sector sort of in time for the crisis to crash down on that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell us how those two experiences bring you to the Occupy Wall Street. How does that happen?
You know, the crisis in 2008, I actually, you know, I remember it and how scary it was quite well. This shop that I represented in Lower Manhattan, they were actually coming into the union hall for a ratification vote the night that Lehman declared its bankruptcy. And I just remember telling those guys, you know, take this deal. It wasn't perfect. Like, you know, no union contract's perfect for everybody involved. But, I mean, you could just see it coming as soon as the market got over the initial shock of one of the largest investment banks having to be orderly unwound, you know, over the next few months. And unfortunately, the orderly unwinding didn't happen. But that just rippled out through the economy to the point where it was just, you know, within a year, the workers who had come in for that ratification vote, their company declared a restructuring bankruptcy. You know, within a few months.
So that's why you told them to take the contract. You could see that a tsunami was coming.
Exactly.
Down. Yeah.
You know, you have something on paper for 3 years. At least it's a little work for a judge to try to vacate it, you know, instead of trying to go back to the bargaining table with all this going on around them. So they were the lucky ones, unbelievably. We had other employers that we had, you know, decades-long relationships with, telling us that they would call their bank where they used to have a $250,000 credit line, and it just evaporated to, you know, $25,000, and sometimes they couldn't even get that. So, you know, they couldn't make product, they couldn't fulfill orders, people were getting laid off left and right. This was right before the CIT bank bankruptcy was.
So this was what, 2009?
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. And they were one of the biggest lenders to the small and middle market. So a lot of, you know, our people got hit by that. So it wasn't just a crisis of investment banks. It was, you know, it very early on was a crisis of Main Street too.
Right. And so, in a sense, it's wonderful because what you're showing is is behind the headlines of the huge banks and the huge breakdowns. There's the thousands of small companies that get kind of choked to death by the drying up of the credit that they need
to work with. Right, exactly.
Okay, so what did you do when in the face of this crunching down of the small shops that you were involved with?
We kind of restructured our the union sort of restructured a lot after that. Kind of merged locals to make bigger locals, trying to, you know, find some bargaining power in a world where it was quickly evaporating. There was also a merger between our union and another union that didn't work out. It was a lot of, you know, politics. They're trying to hang on, I think. And there are some employers out there that want to make their things in America, and they are facing kind of hurdles at every juncture, you know, either through economic development policy or tax policy or, you know, whatever they try to do. They don't get the breaks that, you know, big companies get. I think that, that upsets a lot of them. But there are a lot of good employers that would like to stay here in a manufacturing base, but can't.
All right, so given this sort of storm washing across the American economy in 2009, 2010, give us a sense of how your struggles in that period bumped you up against this new movement and brought you into it.
When I was working for the American Federation of Teachers, their affiliate in New Jersey, a lot of my financial research kind of turned to the municipal bond market. And, without going into the whole deal on financial engineering in the municipal bond market, one of the crises that public sector entities face is the crises of underwater interest rate swaps, of all things. Basically bad derivative products
sold to the communities. Yeah.
Exactly. Back in the day, you would call a banker and you would have some sort of belief that they might be working in your best interest. But just the incentives are so misaligned on Wall Street, I think, that, 25-year-old kid that came out of an Ivy League school wants to sell you this thing because they're going to get a 10% cut. And, you know, it's they're working in their rational interests, but what ends up happening is that, people on the other side of the transaction that, you know, don't have the same information or different information end up in underwater interest rate swaps. And basically those come from a piece of financial engineering where Wall Street tried to turn the municipal bond market, which is, you know, long-term debt, you know, 20, 30 years, something like that, into short-term sort of like money market instruments. And it's similar to the auction rated securities market. I don't want to get into the weeds, but a lot of those markets that tried to turn long term debt into short term debt ended up freezing, basically. Right. And, you know, it didn't work out. But now municipalities are trapped in these 20-30 year contracts, hedging debt.
That are costing them a fortune, right?
Right, exactly.
Well, it has to do with a little bit, if I could interject, just to explain to our listeners, it has to do with the endless possibilities of new financial instruments all the time, the incentive to companies to invent these new ones, often because the new ones are not yet regulated, and so you can do things that you can't do with the older things that now have regulation. The reason the older ones have regulation is because they were abused in the past, so now you come up with a new one that allows you to abuse it because it's not like the old one, and so on and so on and so on. And the incentive of the bankers is to push this bad paper onto the buyers, who are often municipal pension funds or communities. And then, of course, when trouble happens, when you have an economic crisis of this sort, then it's everyone for themselves. The banks run for cover to try to recover, leaving the rest of the society holding the bag. And that's what we kind of have. And it crunched all of you. But let me push you a little bit, because it's about Occupy Wall Street. Give us that last step of how all this brought you into that.
I blame Wall Street for the crisis. I don't think there's anybody else to blame, you know. very sort of short way of saying it, too big to fail caused this. You know, you can kind of point the fingers at Freddie and Fannie Mae, or you can point the finger at the Community Reinvestment Act. And, I mean, those are all diversionary tactics, really. Right. I don't see any respectable economist or even observer of this looking and saying, well, this wasn't the fault of too big to fail, because it was.
We're talking with Christina Towne about Occupy Wall Street, and we're just at the point of asking her how, from her work with the unions struggling in the kind of tsunami unleashed by this economic crisis and having one problem after another, how she comes then in this life trying to cope to this movement. So tell us a little bit how that happened.
Well, I mean, I can say from my knowledge and for a fact that while the media is saying now, well, unions are starting to support Occupy Wall Street, a lot of friends, that I had just working for unions that were in sort of my, personal networks have been there since day one. They were even part of the groups that started organizing the general assemblies over the summer.
That's a very important point. So that union people whose lives are wrapped up with unions, activists in unions, people working for a living for unions, were in a sense, on the ground floor of this whole movement.
Correct. And it might not have been, under their union banners,
right,
quote unquote.
No, understood.
But just through things like Twitter and Facebook, I would get these postings from, my friends who I've worked with for years saying, come on down to Wall Street on September 17th and we're going to put up tents and occupy it, which I thought was a fantastic idea.
Right from the beginning.
Yeah, this is great. Okay, so go to the belly of the beast, right?
Right.
But they eventually got moved from Wall Street up to Zuccotti Park that day. And I didn't go on the 17th. The first time I went was the Monday after, just to kind of like drop off some old supplies that I had. I grew up in New England, so I have a lot of old camping supplies. I brought tarps, that sort of thing. I hung out for a few hours here and there. If you've ever been down there, you kind of have to do that a few times. You just kind of like have to hang out, talk to people, get the feel of what's going on. You can't just like jump in with a ton of ideas and a platform and expect to find a ready-made audience. It takes a little work to get into the movement. So it was really after the arrests in Union Square that when I saw all the videos on YouTube that a lot of people saw of that police officer pepper spraying two women who were standing there doing absolutely nothing.
Tell us a little bit, how did that exactly impact you, seeing those videos of the pepper spray by that, I believe, white-shirted police officer?
Right, yeah. He lost 10 days of vacation was his...
Yeah, it was amazing. After weeks of investigation, The city decided to take 10 days of his vacation for pepper spraying in the face women who weren't doing anything.
Exactly. Yeah. They were just standing on the sidewalk. I think it's... Over the last, I'd say, since I was a kid, protest movements have been sort of eroded by this idea that, well, you have to be on this sidewalk, you can't be on this sidewalk, you got to get this permit, you can't have this megaphone, you can't have a sound stage, you can't, like, all these bureaucratic rules that you have to jump through to exercise your First Amendment rights. If you want to have a bunch of people with signs outside, even a private business or when Naomi Wolf got arrested a few days ago, she made this point that when the protesters from Occupy Wall Street were trying to send a message to Andrew Cuomo's dinner, they couldn't do it anywhere near the dinner. They had to be a block and a half away inside nets, and I think that really sort of disintegrates any type of movement or any type of ability for people to redress grievances. You have the right under the First Amendment to petition your government for redress. And by saying, well, you can't really do that in front of your government, you got to do it on the other side of the island. I think that's tragic. And I think if we don't stand up for our First Amendment rights, we'll end up losing them slowly and surely over time to things like this.
So you wanted, if I can paraphrase, you wanted to make a statement, to stand up against what was going on, And seeing the women pepper sprayed there kind of took you over some sort of line to where you wanted to participate yourself.
Yeah, and if you've been down there,
yes, I have.
And other people I know that I've talked to, is you walk into the park and you get a sense that like something really interesting is going on, even if you can't really put your finger on it. So that's kind of like how I felt before I started going down there during the days and full time. But it was actually the NYPD that really brought out the numbers for Occupy Wall Street. When that hit the television, and I don't usually give a head nod to the mainstream media, but it was MSNBC that really put that on nationwide. A lot of people just the next day, just started streaming in and saying, what can we do? I think a lot of people were horrified by what happened to those young people trying to express their views.
That was labor activist Christina Towne, interviewed by WBAI's Richard Wolf, 10 days before the Occupy Wall Street eviction.
You are listening to Circle A Radio. In this past week, we've seen a nationwide campaign to evict protesters from Occupy encampments. Tonight, we focus on the political analysis and the economics that gave rise to this historic movement in the first place, the financial crisis caused by Wall Street and the financial institutions it represents. On October 22nd, Noam Chomsky, longtime critic of the U.S. capitalist system and vocal supporter of Occupy Wall Street, spoke at Occupy Boston.
It is an extremely exciting development. In fact, it's kind of spectacular and unprecedented. There's never been anything like it that I can think of. If the bonds and associations that are being established in these remarkable events can be sustained through a long, hard period ahead, because victories don't come quickly, it could turn out to be a very significant moment in American history. The fact that the Occupy movement is unprecedented is quite appropriate. It's an unprecedented era, not just this moment, but actually since the 1970s. In the 1970s began a major turning point in American history. For centuries, since the country began, it had been a developing society. And not in very pretty ways, that's another story, but it was a developing society with ups and downs, but a general progress towards wealth, industrialization, development, even in dark and hope. There was a lot of pretty near constant expectation that it's going to go on like this. That was true even in very dark times. I'm just old enough to remember the Great Depression, and after the first few years, by the mid-30s, although the situation was objectively much harsher than it is today, nevertheless, the spirit was quite different. There was a sense that we're going to get out of it, even among unemployed people, a lot of my relatives. There's a militant labor movement organizing, CIO organizing is going on. It was getting to the point of sit-down strikes, which really are very frightening to the business world. You can see it in the business press at the time, because a sit-down strike is just a step before taking over the factory and running it yourself. And something which, incidentally, is very much on the agenda today, and we should keep in mind. I'll come back to it. Also, the New Deal legislations were beginning to come under popular pressure, and there just was a sense somehow we're going to get out of it. It's quite different now. And now there's a kind of pervasive sense of hopelessness, sometimes despair. I think it's quite new in American history, and it has an objective basis. In the 1930s, unemployed working people could anticipate realistically that the jobs are going to come back. If you're a worker in manufacturing today, and the level of unemployment in manufacturing is approximately like the Depression, if current tendencies persist, those jobs aren't going to come back. The change took place in the 70s. A lot of reasons for it. One of the underlying reasons, discussed mainly by economic historian Robert Brenner, has done a lot of work on it, is the falling rate of profit. There were other factors. It led to major changes in the economy. A reversal of the several hundred years of progress towards industrialization and development, and turn to a process of deindustrialization and de-development. Of course, manufacturing production continued, but overseas. Very profitable, but no good for the workforce. And along with that came a significant shift of the economy from productive enterprise, producing things people need or can use, to financial manipulation. Financialization of the economy really took off at that time. Before the 70s, banks were banks. They did what banks are supposed to do in a state capitalist economy, take unused funds, like, say, your bank account, and transfer it to some potentially useful purpose, like buying a home, sending a kid to college, or whatever it might be. That changed radically. And incidentally, there were no financial crises. It was a period of enormous growth, the highest growth in American history, maybe in economic history, sustained growth through the 50s and the 60s, and it was egalitarian. So the lowest quintile did about as well as the highest quintile. A lot of people moved into reasonable lifestyles, what's called here middle class, working class, it's called in other countries. But they, it was real. And the 60s accelerated it. The activism of the 60s, after a pretty dismal decade, really civilized the country in lots of ways that are permanent. They're not changing, they're staying on. 70s came along, sudden sharp change, deindustrialization, offshoring of production, shifting to financial institutions, which grew enormously. I should say that in the 50s and the 60s, there was also the development of what several decades later became the high-tech economy. Computers, internet, IT revolution, mostly developed in the 50s and the 60s, substantially in the state sector. It took a couple of decades before it took off, but it was developed there. The 1970s, the developments that took place, set off a kind of a vicious cycle. It led to concentration of wealth, increasingly in the hands of the financial sector, which doesn't benefit the economy, probably harms it and the society. But it did lead to tremendous concentration of wealth, substantially there. Concentration of wealth yields concentration of political power, which in turn gives rise to legislation that increases, that accelerates the cycle, the fiscal policies, tax changes, rules of corporate governance, deregulation, essentially bipartisan. Alongside of this began the very sharp rise in costs of elections, which drives the political parties even deeper than before into the pockets of the corporate sector. A couple of years later started a different process, which has been described particularly by Tom Ferguson, who's going to be here Monday. He probably will talk about it, so I won't much. But parties dissolved, essentially. It used to be that if a person in Congress hoped for a position of, say, a committee chair or something, some position of responsibility, you got it mainly through seniority and service. Within a couple of years, you started having to put money into the party coffers in order to get ahead. That just drove the whole system even deeper into the pockets of the corporate sector, increasingly the financial sector. A tremendous concentration of wealth, mainly in literally the top one-tenth of 1% of the population. Meanwhile, for the general population, it began and opened a period of pretty much stagnation or even decline for the majority. People got by, but by pretty artificial means, borrowings, a lot of debt, the longer working hours, but pretty soon much higher than in other industrial countries, even past Japan. The political system began to dissolve. There's always been a gap between public policy and the public will, but it just grew kind of astronomically. Take a look at what's happening right now. The big topic in Washington, everyone concentrates on, is the deficit. For the public, correctly, the deficit is not regarded as much of an issue, and it isn't really much of an issue. The issue is joblessness, not a deficit. Now, there's a deficit commission, but there's no joblessness commission. As far as the deficit is concerned, you want to pay attention to it. The public has opinions. Take a look at the polls. Overwhelmingly support higher taxes on the wealthy, which have declined sharply. The outcome of the deficit commission is probably going to be the opposite. Either they'll reach an agreement, which will be the opposite of what the public wants, or else it goes into automatic procedure, which is going to have those effects. Actually, that's something that has to be done very quickly. Deficit commission's going to come up with its decision in a couple of weeks. The Occupy movements could provide a mass base for trying to avert what amounts to a dagger pointed at the heart of the country. It could have very negative effects. It's an immediate task. Well, without going on in the details, what's being played out for the last 30 years is actually a kind of a nightmare that was anticipated by the classical economists. If you take, say, Adam Smith, bother to read Wealth of Nations, he considered the possibility that merchants and manufacturers in England might decide to do their business abroad, invest abroad, and import from abroad. He said they would profit, but England would be harmed. However, he went on to say that merchants and manufacturers would prefer to operate in their own country, what's sometimes called a home bias. So as if by an invisible hand, England would be saved the ravages of what's now called neoliberal globalization. That's a pretty hard passage to miss. In his classic Wealth of Nations, that's the only occurrence of the phrase invisible hand. Maybe England would be saved from neoliberal globalization by an invisible hand. The other great classical economist, David Ricardo, recognized the same thing and hoped that it wouldn't happen, kind of a sentimental hope. And it didn't for a long time, but now it's happening. In the last 30 years, that's exactly what's been underway. For the general population, you know, the 99% in the imagery of the Occupy movement, it's been pretty harsh, and it could get worse. And this could be a period of irreversible decline. For the 1%, even more, 0.1%, it's just fine. They're at the top of the richer than ever, more powerful than ever, controlling the political system, disregarding the public. And if it can continue, sure, why not? Just what Smith and Ricardo warned about. And so, for example, take, say, Citigroup. For decades, one of the most corrupt of the major investment banking corporations, repeatedly bailed out by the taxpayer over and over again, starting in the early Reagan years. Now, once again, I won't run through the corruption, probably know about it, but it's pretty astonishing. A couple of years ago, they came out with a brochure for investors. They urged investors to put their money in what they call the Plutonomy Index. They said the world is dividing into a plutonomy, you know, the rich, those who buy luxury goods and so on. And that's where the action is. They said their plutonomy index is way outperforming the stock market, so put your money into it. And as for the rest, we set them adrift. We don't really care about them. We don't need them. They have to be around to provide a powerful state, which will protect us and bail us out when we get into trouble, but other than that, they essentially have no function. They're sometimes called these days the precariat. the people who live a precarious existence of the periphery of society. It's not the periphery anymore. It's becoming a very substantial part of the society in the United States and indeed elsewhere. And this is considered a good thing. So, for example, Alan Greenspan, hailed by the economics profession as one of the greatest economists of all time, this is before the crash that, for which he was substantially responsible, he was testifying to Congress in the Clinton years. Greenspan testified that the very successful economy he was supervising, which has the properties I described, was based substantially on growing worker insecurity. If working people are insecure, if they're part of what we now call the precariat, living precarious existences, they're not going to make demands, they're not going to try to get wages, they won't get benefits. We can kick them out if we don't like them. And that's good for the health of the economy. That's what's called a healthy economy, technically. And he was very highly praised for this, greatly admired. Well, now the world is indeed splitting into a plutonomy and a precariat, again, in the imagery of the Occupy movements, the 1% and the 99%, you know, not literal numbers, but the right picture. And the plutonomy is where the action is. Well, it could continue like this. And if it does continue, this historic reversal that began in the 1970s could become irreversible. That's where we're heading. And the Occupy movements are the first real popular reaction, which could avert this. But as I said, it's going to be necessary to face the fact that it's a long, hard struggle. You don't win victories tomorrow. Have to go on. Have to form structures that will be sustained. They'll go on through hard times and can win major victories. Now, there are a lot of things that can be done. I mentioned before that in the 1930s, one of the most effective actions was a sit-down strike. And the reason is very simple. That's just a step before takeover of the industry. Well, through the 70s, as the decline was setting in, there were some very important events that took place. One was in the late 70s, 1977. U.S. Steel decided to close one of its major facilities, Youngstown, Ohio, and instead of just walking away, the workforce and the community decided to get together and buy it from U.S. Steel and hand it over to the workforce to run and turn it into a worker-owned, worker-management facility. They didn't win, but with enough popular support, they could have won. And it was a partial victory. This is a topic that Igor Alperovitz particularly has discussed in detail. It was a partial victory because even though they lost, it set off other efforts. And now throughout Ohio, and in fact in other places, there's a scattering, hundreds, maybe thousands of sometimes not so small worker-owned or at least partially worker-owned industries which could become worker-managed. And that's the basis for a real revolution. That's how it takes place.
That was Noam Chomsky. Hear the rest of the speech at OccupyBoston.org.
On November 15th, this open letter to the people of Portland was posted at OccupyPortland.org. An open letter to the people of Portland. On November 13th, the City of Portland and the Portland Police carried out an eviction of Occupy Portland in the Lonsdale and Chapman Squares. As the clock struck midnight, thousands of you supported us peacefully protesting the eviction. By dawn, the police requested for us to open up the streets and directed us to enter the parks that they had been trying to evict us from. We peacefully obliged. They left, and we celebrated. Mayor Sam Adams came out and spoke to the media about the respect he wished to show Portlanders and how surprise raids were dangerous and counterproductive. Despite this, only hours later, the remaining exhausted people at Occupy Portland were confronted by a disproportionately large group of riot police again attempting to carry out the eviction. Several officers engaged in deplorable behavior, completely unfitting of a public safety officer, including beating peaceful protesters with batons. Several of us were left with injuries and were treated in reprehensible ways, with our First Amendment rights being violated. Justin Bridges, a beloved member of our community and Occupy Portland's only ASL interpreter, fell due to a pre-existing injury. Yet once he had fallen, he was dragged through the mud, choked by his collar until he lost consciousness, and injured by the police until he had lost use of both legs and his right arm. He was hospitalized for these injuries and is now in a wheelchair, living with what he describes as excruciating pain. Police Chief Mike Reese came out after the parks were cleared to congratulate his officers and the protesters for being so peaceful. The Portland Police Bureau claimed that no officers or protesters were injured, as reported in the Oregonian. That is a lie. Mike Reese, 2 weeks ago, announced he was considering a run for mayor. Simultaneously, the city and the police bureau began publicly talking more and more about safety problems and deliberately doing less and less to solve them. These things are not a coincidence. Everyone in this city knows who Mike Reese is now. He was able to stand up in front of the cameras and in front of the city and declare that special kind of victory where everyone wins. That story is a fantasy, elaborately created. The truth is that his officers tried very hard to provoke us into violence, doing things as petty as sticking feet out and tripping protesters, and when we did not turn violent, some retaliated in brutal force anyways. What happened in our city at dawn on Sunday was an incredible moral victory for our movement and a clear sign of how we as people hold the key to our peaceful future. What then happened just a few hours later made November 13th into a dark day in this city's history, as the First Amendment rights of the peacefully assembled were violated and soiled as part of a political campaign advertisement. They were suspended for the business interest that Mr. Reese is so close with that must be pleased if he truly wants to be elected. Portland, this is exactly the flavor of corruption in our electoral process that we are protesting against. Yesterday, our city government engaged in hostile behavior, not because the people of this city demanded it. Indeed, the enormous turnout that night speaks quite the opposite. But because the business interests of the city continue to successfully manipulate our municipality and our representatives in ways kept secret from the general public. Portland is better than this. The rest of this letter can be found at OccupyPortland.org. We now finish our show with audio from the night of November 12th.
What they don't tell you!
What they don't tell you!
Is the homeless were here long before!
Is the homeless were here long before!
This camp existed!
This camp existed!
Violence existed long before!
Violence existed long before!
My name is Mitchell David Scott. I actually came down because I was illegally camped out in Beaverton, Oregon. And the cops, once they found my campsite, harassed me at my job so much that I actually got fired. Yeah, because it was portraying the wrong image to the customers. So I'm down here basically because the police were abusing their power. Yeah. And all they're doing here is strong-arming people and trying to scare them off. So if everybody stays, we're golden.
We're trying to light candles so that we can show solidarity and peace.
I think that the movement itself has great potential. Tonight is not the end, of course. And the great thing is that the spirit of the movement is actually, I think it's being rekindled a little bit, because there was a bit of time where a lot of people were disenfranchised with being evicted from the park because they're like, this is the movement. And like I said before, this is not the movement. It just draws attention to the movement.
If you ignore a segment of your population, you're going to have to keep an eye on certain parts of your own being, because crime is a direct proportion with unemployment. As unemployment grow, we're going to see the crime numbers spike. So the action is pretty simple. We just need to clean up the leaders and get some progressive minds in there and do the right thing.
You know, I've heard a lot of people talk about being visible, and I think that's really important, because even though there is a majority of us, we get made invisible. And so I do like the idea of being visible.
All we have is our hope and our bodies. That's all we have left, you know? All power to the people. We will win in the end. The arc of human history is long, but bends toward justice. Martin Luther King said that.
Some of you may know, some of you may not know, but a lot of this started because of a plan, a global plan. It's a very simple plan. That plan has three phases. Phase one is gather. Phase two is organize. Phase three is act. Phase one started on June 15th, and it ends on November 15th. So in 3 days, begin to organize. Because in a couple more months, we're going to begin to act. And then things are going to change.
Yeah. And they're coming. Indeed. Indeed.
We are all love.
We are all love.
We are all family.
We are all family.
We are all disappointed.
We are all disappointed.
But we all know that this was inevitable.
We all know that this was inevitable.
This does not mean the end.
This does not mean the end.
The heart of this movement.
The heart of this movement.
Is not in these parts.
It's not in these parts.
Occupy Portland's Action Committee has issued a call for decentralized yet coordinated nonviolent civil disobedience against big banks. They are inviting everyone to join the public march on the morning of Thursday, November 17th. The protest starts at 8 a.m. on the east side of the Steel Bridge with an action in support of organized labor, demanding jobs, not cuts, hosted by We Are Oregon. Then a 10 a.m. rally at Waterfront Park and Southwest Ankeny. At 11, there will be a march to visit civil disobedience actions in progress. For more information, visit the website n17pdx.org.
Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. Circle A Radio can be heard the first and third Wednesdays here on your member-owned community radio station, KBOO Portland. To contact us, you can email circlearadio@gmail.com or through the KBOO website, kboo.fm, where you can hear many of our past shows. Thanks for listening.
We gon' occupy. The power's with the people. Don't let these cowards deceive you and be the next mouse in the talons of an eagle. This country's wealth gap is an unbalanced. It's evil. We celebrate access while the people have less. And poverty, abject madness. While the economy collapses, add stress. That's the last straw. You want class? Well, we'll give you what you ask for. The have-nots at the haves. Though we came to crash your party, and we ain't leaving until we even. The Constitution guarantees these freedoms. Anyone against that committing treason, you're not a real patriot unless you stand for what you believe in.
leaving. And nobody got more welfare than Wall Street. Hundreds of billions after operating falsely. And nobody went to prison, that's where you lost me. But my home, my job, and my life is what it cost me. We in 99.